From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Meghna and I are ready. She with her ISO-certified glasses. Be careful. She's got them on. Some vendors are slapping the sticker on fake ones. I have my cardboard box with the pinhole. We're ready for the Great American Eclipse, which will launch in about an hour. And when it does, we're going to follow it across the country, not as the ancients thought as a sign of the end of the world, but as confirmation that all is right with the world. We'll get to the day's other news, but let's start with Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent. He's in Washington. And Joe, have I got that right? You know, eclipses come in cycles, so this is a good thing.
A good thing. Well, I guess so. I'm just curious, though. You've got your glasses on. Can you see the sun from your studio?
No, but we're ready.
I see. And just in case.
A cardboard box on your head is even weirder.
I see, yeah. I mean, that's prepared, boy. I'm telling you.
But what I meant was, you know, we know the Mayans thought it meant that the earth would split open and jaguars would rise up and eat everyone. We know that this is a cycle, and scientists have known about it for a long time.
I like the jaguar theory. I was actually, when I was coming in this morning, I think I saw a bobcat, which was pretty unusual. So, yes, it's a cycle. It is amazing, though, if you think about it. I mean, I was thinking if somebody asked me to prove that the Earth went around the sun and not vice versa, it would be hard for me to just prove it to you. I'm used to it. I follow it. I believe it. I know it's happening. But somebody figured that out, and somebody figured out that these eclipses come in a cycle of about every 18 years and 11 days.
Right.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Well, and it's amazing that it happens. You have the Earth, the moon, and the sun perfectly lined up. The sun is 400 times the size of the moon. So remind us how the moon can block it.
Well, because it's 400 times further away.
Right.
It's one of these perfect things. You know, you can hold your thumb out and block the sun out if you want to. And it's the same idea. It takes up the same amount of space in the sky, essentially.
Right.
And it's just one of these cosmic accidents that the moon happens to be at exactly the right spot in the relative to the Earth and the sun, that it will completely block out the sun when it happens to fall exactly between the sun and the Earth.
It is amazing. Right. And now let's start with people who will be seeing totality first. This is the swath of the country from Oregon to South Carolina. If you haven't got your space yet, you're probably not going to get one there. So they're going to have the totality for about two and a half minutes in some parts where the moon completely covers the sun. What should they be looking for? We know there's gaseous, you know, there's gas around the sun that's going to show up as a corona. What do you look for?
Right. Well, yes, that seems to be the most spectacular thing because normally you can't see it. It's wispy clouds of extremely hot gas. It's kind of interesting that the surface of the sun is about 6,000 or 5,500 degrees centigrade. And these clouds of gas in the outer atmosphere, in the atmosphere, in the corona, as you called it, is in the millions of degrees centigrade. So how does it get to be so hot? Well, it does, and that's one of the things that scientists would like to know more about. But it's visible, this atmosphere, which is normally completely blotted out by the brightness of the rest of the sun. Yeah. So you get to see that. And afterwards, I don't know, it seems just to have a magical effect on some people.
Yes, it does. And it takes a while. It doesn't just quickly go back to light after darkness. It takes a while. But talk to people who are seeing partial eclipses. By the way, you know, we can't say it enough. You can only look at the totality while it's in totality for a couple of minutes. Everyone, when it's partially eclipsed, which is in other parts of the country, must have some kind of protection. We'll talk more about that in the program. But what will you look for there? I mean, how long does it stay dark? How long does it cover? What happens?
Well, it doesn't become dramatically dark. Unless you're in this umbra, the main shadow of the moon. And you're right. I mean, people say, even a partial eclipse is dangerous. Well, no, it's only a partial eclipse that's dangerous, which is interesting. But it's the same essentially ideas. Don't look at the sun when there's not an eclipse. I mean, don't look at the sun. It's a bad idea. It'll burn out cells in the back of your eye, in the retina.
Right.
So the thing is that when it's partially covered, you think, maybe it's not that dangerous if it's mostly, you know, like here in Washington, it's going to be 80 or 81% covered by this disk of the moon. So it's only 20% of normal. No, wrong, bad. You still have to wear careful eyewear. And it's nothing like wearing dark sunglasses. I don't know if you've seen these glasses, but you can't see
right at
anything
with Magna.
If you're inside them. Yeah, well, ask Magna if she can see you, because if she can, she's got the wrong glasses.
Joe, we have only 30 seconds here. We're going to talk to you again over the course of the day. How excited are you, scientist?
It's a science event, which is very interesting, but it's an event. I mean, you know, people have been revving up for this for years, and it's just one of those social, amazing, whole country human experiences.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk to you again. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And Joe, just to let you know, I cannot see Robin. These come from Sky and Telescope, and they are certified, so we're okay here.
Sounds safe.
By the way, I'm just looking at some telescope feeds from NASA, and out in Madras, Oregon, the moon is just starting to just graze the edge of the sun.
Very exciting.
All right, well, let's take a step away from the eclipse for a moment and turn to politics, because tonight, in a nationally televised primetime address, President Trump will unveil his strategy for Afghanistan, spelling out a plan that he hopes will lead to a better outcome there after 16 years at war. Now, this comes as the president finds himself further isolated politically following his remarks last week defending some of the protesters at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. So joining us with more is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi there, Ron.
Hello, Magna.
So first of all, what is at stake for the president in his announcement tonight on Afghanistan?
Most immediately, what's at stake is the fate of thousands of American troops who are still there. We still have something like 8,500 troops in Afghanistan, and thousands more who may be going there shortly after tonight. And of course, what's at stake is the 16-year mission that these soldiers have been fighting. Not all of them, of course, all that time, but American soldiers have been there for 16 years in great numbers, as one time as many as 100,000, trying to defeat the Taliban and stand up a government in Afghanistan that would be more friendly to the West, and at least not part of the Islamic Revolution. So that's what's at stake in the speech tonight. On one level, on another level, the president is really trying to change the narrative about his own presidency, which has gotten seriously off the rails this summer.
Now, about Afghanistan, before we get to the off the rails part here, Ron, I mean, how much would what the president is likely to say tonight differ from what he said on the campaign trail? He was very critical of President Obama's Afghanistan policy.
It does seem as though it's going to be quite different, because if we're talking about sending about half again as many troops as we have there now, that's clearly a continuation of the steady state policy. Let's not let things get worse in Afghanistan, but let's not go charging in and try to completely remake the region. Let's not send a huge force as we did 15 years ago, 16 years ago. Let's just try not to lose, to put it in the terms that have been used by people like Senator John McCain and criticizing President Obama's policy, and that were used 4 years ago when Donald Trump, in his pre-candidate stage, was criticizing exactly that strategy and saying we should either go in and finish it in a hurry or we should get out of Afghanistan. And we were hearing more of that kind of tone from Donald Trump when he was a candidate.
Now, do you think that the president is likely to say something, anything, about a reaction to his remarks on the protests in Charlottesville, Virginia? I mean, former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney has urged him to address the nation about this.
He is not likely to say anything that would seem to be in response to Mitt Romney or to any of his critics among Republican senators, or perhaps some of his critics that he does need to deal with even within his own administration. He is more likely to say something, much as he did via Twitter over the weekend, about how great the events in Boston were on Saturday, when a small billed as free speech rally was largely overwhelmed by counter demonstrators who came to talk about harmony and diversity. And Donald Trump was very, very supportive of that over the weekend, saying that was great, that was good. We're all going to heal as a nation. Sounding quite different, of course, from the way he had sounded on Tuesday at Trump Tower. So he may try to strike some more of that tone, and possibly with a few shots at the media as well. We continue to see that in his Twitter feed. But he will try to be as positive as possible about the aftermath of Charlottesville.
Right. And you mentioned Boston. Largely overwhelmed is the phrase there, right? About 100 of the original so-called free speech protesters, perhaps as many as 40,000 people counter-protesting this weekend in Boston. So, Ron, you know, the president is getting energetic support, obviously, from folks like Jerry Falwell. He defended the president this morning, saying the president does not have a racist bone in his body. He knows him well. Have you ever seen anything like this, though, in all your years covering Washington, this sort of reaction and counter-reaction about such a critical issue and how the president's handled it?
We've seen some bad times over the last 20, 30 years, including the impeachment of Bill Clinton and some very low times for George W. Bush. But really, the only thing that compares to this is before my time in Washington. Back in my student days, I watched a lot of the Watergate hearings in 1973, and there was a great deal of meltdown during 73 and 74 in the Nixon administration, leading ultimately to his resignation in the summer of 1974. Yeah. Nothing really since then that would compare to that.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Meghna.
Good morning, Mr. Mealy. I notice on the door you're Milton and Mealy. I am your orderly.
At one point, Jerry Lewis was one of the highest paid and most beloved performers in America, with rubbery-faced characters like the Nutty Professor and here the disorderly orderly, and those signature sayings.
The expression was never, hey, lady, ever. It was just lady.
He was hilarious. He was also mercurial, sometimes both at the same time. To interview him was to play straight man.
Before we leave the physicality of it,
wait
I just
a minute.
Ask,
who told you I was
sorry.
Finished?
Sorry.
What the hell is the matter with you?
So sorry.
We spoke with Jerry Lewis in 2005. He died yesterday at 91. He'd raised almost $2.5 billion for muscular dystrophy through his sleep-deprived dramatic telethons. He was a wildly successful film, recording, and TV star. And before that, he was half of one of the most popular comic teams in history, Martin and Lewis, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Every time we're on TV, you gotta louse me up with the opening thing. You gotta take me someplace and embarrass me. I don't
you
like
can't
that.
Hide my feelings. Nothing you can say could make me feel abused.
Introduce my song.
Go ahead, get off the stage.
Introduce
get
my
off
song.
The stage. I don't want to argue with you.
But despite the success, Jerry Lewis could be resentful that he wasn't taken more seriously, and he was especially defensive of his comedy partner of 10 years, the crooner Dean Martin. When they met in the 40s, Jerry Lewis was 19, the skinny son of a vaudevillian and a piano player, so desperate to be famous it affected his breathing. But his first act, he didn't even speak.
It was called a dumb act because I never spoke. I did an impression of Frank, Lily Pons with a fright wig on. I was the intermission act.
Well, then there comes one day, cue the choir singing and the clouds part and the sun shaft comes down on a street in New York and you see Dean Martin.
And he walked across the street and he had a camel's hair coat on, wraparound belt, very casual, but he looked like an Adonis. He was tan, had his new nose. He was handsome. And the first thing that struck me was, God, I wish he was my friend. I remember thinking that. It was just something wonderful about him. And it happened. We met. Our friendship really built quickly. But we never got together theatrically for another 6-7 months.
Right. You had acts that were back-to-back at a small club, and you started interacting a little bit between the acts, but you weren't really in an act together.
No. No, I decided one night to give him a spritz. He was doing a lovely love song, Where or When, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was perfect. I put on a busboy's jacket, and I began to rattle the front table. And that was the first time I was awestruck when he stopped singing and he said, and I suppose you'd like to be in show business too, huh? I never heard such a feline in my life. I did something. I motivated his next move and he said, come up here. If you think it's so easy, stand over there and do it. I said, what the hell are you talking about? I can't sing. He says you can make a lot of noise.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever the hell happened in that first 5 minutes started something. Because when we were through, he came to my dressing room, which was a nail. He said, you were magical talking. I said, well, I never do that. You know, I do my act. It's dumb. He said, but something happens. There's more than just miming. And I loved what I heard because nobody had ever been that supportive.
Our conversation from 2005 with Jerry Lewis, who died yesterday at 91. Martin and Lewis would be together for 10 years. Their first gig was at a small club in the 1940s. The mobsters who owned it said, it better be good or else. When we spoke, Jerry still had the sandwich bag that he mapped out their strategy on.
And I took the pastrami sandwich out of the bag and I ripped it in the center. I told him what I would do, where he'd have the chance to respond. We did 2 hours and 20 minutes. To an audience of 11 people. By the fifth night, we had 1,000 people around the block. For Dean, he knew that we had lightning in a bottle. I knew that I had come across a genius, and I couldn't believe what we had.
What you're doing in this act is parting your hair down the middle, popping in the buck teeth, running around while he's singing, taking people's food, spritzing people, cutting off people's ties. Were you ever afraid the audience would sue you? What you did to that audience?
I had people sitting ringside that came there to get their ties cut. When we opened at the Copa, Milton Berle would sit at the center table of Lindy's with every comic in New York. And he said simply, most of you guys have seen them. Is someone going to tell me what the hell they do? He said, so far I hear it's a handsome guy that sings nice and a monkey. What was happening was this simple. One guy says, did you take a bath this morning? And the kid says, why? Is there one missing? You don't make $200 million with that material. Then what is it? They wanted to see two men who loved one another and having the goddamnedest good time. We lost kids in the war. We weren't sure what the hell was happening in the Pacific. 45, everybody was really walking around, thrilled that it was all over, but what do we do now? And we, as though God said, here's a very good time to bring them out.
After your films, the critics loved you, and they didn't get Dean. Sometimes called him the empty suit. Do you think that that was the beginning of the break?
Oh, God, no. The break was just a bunch of people on the outside looking at two people in love, and they're going to divide them.
What, whispering to him?
No, just saying to me, you know, you could do it all by yourself. And all of a sudden, that little poison drip gets in there, and someone is saying to him, what do you need him for? And that little drop is in there. And before you know it, you're buying into it. You don't even know how that happened. How could they destroy this love? It's easy. When we split up, we received about 900,000 letters. What right do you have to spoil what we loved? When Frank Sinatra brought Dean on the telethon in 1976, Dean and I hadn't talked for 20 years. That was, of course, a case of stupidity, but that's what happened. Frank finishes the number. He says, Jerry, a friend of mine loves what you do. Could I bring him out? Come on out here, pal. And he strolls out. Oy, this handsome Adonis with his cigarette and the tan and the high collar. And I say to myself, dear God, give me something to say. And I looked at him and I said, how you been? And now there's a slight pause, and I said, you working? And then his son was killed in an airplane accident. I called my wife. I said, honey, my partner died today. The light of his life was Dino. And when he lost him, I knew it was a matter of time. He let himself go. He drank like everybody thought he did in his career, which he didn't. And he was waiting to die. So I'm on the phone with him now. I said, Dean, please listen to me. There's a lot of life left here. There's a lot of things we can do. There's a lot of children that love you. And you know what you mean to me. Jared, look, I love two men in my life, Dino and you. Now, that's the first time I had ever heard him express love. We get through talking, and I get a letter, which he's never done. And he wrote in the letter, this was the time for me to tell you, I never stopped loving you. I'm sorry for whatever we did to one another, and I love you very much, and I'll try to get through this like a man. It took 4 years, but he died. But what he did while he was here was so much more, so that the day Dean died, Christmas of 95, I sat down at the typewriter that night, and I was going to tell the jerks that never recognized what he was, not only was he the best recording artist, and you got to look at a man that was nominated for an Oscar, you also have to recognize that if he wasn't there, I would have been a record act, nothing more. And I'm living with this all these years. I needed to almost do penance for the 10 years he took of being disregarded or thought of lightly. How can you look at that crazy maniac and not see that the strings are in Dean's hands? I'm not being overly humble. I know how goddamn good I am, and I know how goddamn funny I can be, but with him, it was just a little better. And without him, I'm still working at it. But I'll be all right.
Jerry Lewis, in 2005, his memoir is titled Dean and Me, A Love Story. Jerry Lewis died yesterday at 91.
The moon is starting to slide in front of the sun in Oregon, and people around the country are waiting for their chance to see the eclipse in the American eclipse of 2017. Maybe you're even stuck in traffic trying to get to a spot where you can see it, because there's a lot in America that's going to slow down today, including productivity. Now, while tourism in some places might be boosted, there's a study out by the firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas, and they found that U.S. employers could lose around $700 million in output today during the eclipse. For more on that, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is called Better Off. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, I'm just going to come out here and say it. $700 million, that's a lot, but this is a celestial event. The U.S. economy can afford to have a $700 million pause, can't it?
I would think so. Just to tell you the truth is that this segment might not be as good as it could have been because I was busy building a viewer out of my Nespresso box. So I didn't have glasses. But
So being productive is what you're saying.
Exactly. Or productive in a different way. So here's how they came up with this number. At Challenger Gray and Christmas, they went into the Bureau of Labor Statistics' most recent American time use survey, okay? And then they basically said, how many people are working, you know, again, full-time, also part-time? How much is the average wage in this country? It's just under 24 bucks an hour. They do the math, and $700 million or so is what they come up with as lost productivity.
Interesting. I imagine that a lot of people may have lost productivity trying to reload the websites where they can watch these the eclipse feeds from telescopes, because they're not loading. There's a lot of people online right now. But tell me, how does this differ from other major events, weather events? You know, we've had blizzards that bring half the country to a standstill.
Absolutely. And that's obviously a much more significant event because transportation stops. But I will say there are other sort of fun events you might use as a means of comparison. For example, March Madness. It has been estimated that productivity lost $615 million for each hour viewed of the NCAA college tournament, just under $2 billion for the whole tournament. How about the Super Bowl? The Monday after the Super Bowl, $290 million in lost output for every 10 minutes watching highlights of the game and the commercials. Don't forget the commercials. I have two other stats that blew my mind, okay? Fantasy football is estimated to cost $990 million per each hour spent on fantasy football. And ladies and gentlemen, the folks at CNBC did a nice estimate of Amazon Prime Day, where they came up with about a $10 billion of lost productivity of people looking for deals on Amazon Prime Day.
That is amazing. Given those numbers, you'd think that the breathtaking event of watching the moon blot out the sun might be worth a little bit more than $700 million. But Jill, just quickly, in the last 30 seconds that we have, what about the local boost to the economy in places where tourism is, you know, huge today?
Yes, and that is absolutely true. It probably overall will not make up for that loss of productivity. But I agree with you. I mean, considering that economists on average find that we spend about 34 minutes a day doing nothing anyway on any regular day, take an extra 20 minutes, do your coffee, go watch this event with the proper glasses or your homemade ones, and enjoy yourself. And just, you know, we have fun with numbers sometimes, but yeah, this is a very cool event.
Go test your pinhole box. See if it works, Jill.
Take care.
And on this special day, I have a little special poem to read all of you. It's a short one, and it goes like this. Sunset at night is natural, but sunset on the dawn reverses nature. Master, so midnight's due at noon. Eclipses be predicted, and science bows them in. But do one face us suddenly, Jehovah's watch is wrong. Well, that's Emily Dickinson, circa 1862, and it's one of the reasons why I'm very excited to speak with Matthew Zapruder. He's the author of a new book called Why Poetry, and he joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So what did you make of my reading of Emily Dickinson's Eclipse poem?
I thought it was great. I loved it. I was immediately in the presence of the great one, Emily Dickinson.
I mean, the reason why I wanted to start with that is obviously today's a very special day. But, you know, and you asked this question about why poetry. I feel like that's a perfect answer, that poetry is able to capture things, moments, transcendent experiences, even transcendent physical experiences in a way that virtually no other art form can.
I think so. And just to suddenly feel that the experience of this person who lived in the mid-19th century is, in a way, very much like the one that we're having today.
Hmm. Well, in your book, you talk about how poetry oftentimes, though, is something that people might find intimidating, right? If they, first of all, on first blush, don't necessarily connect with, you know, someone like Emily Dickinson, maybe they're put off by it.
I think that we've been told that the wrong thing is difficult about poetry. We've been told that it's hard to understand, and that the words often don't mean what they seem to mean or would mean in other places in our lives, or that there's some hidden message we need to dig up and uncover, and that's the point of reading poems. And that's not true. What's hard about it is that it's unfamiliar, and it requires us to slow down and concentrate and maybe accept some new thoughts and new ways of thinking. But that's also what's exciting about it. And so its difficulty is something other than the scholarly difficulty that has been communicated to us.
I mean, so is part of the problem how poetry is taught? Is it something that should even be taught? Because I know I've sat in many a class where we might read a poem and the instructor, with the best of intentions, will say, well, you see this line here, this stanza here, what the poet is saying is blah, 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 right? And it, and it's like, well, really? Because that's not what's on the page.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've been in those classes myself. I think that it can be taught, but it should not be taught in that way. It should be taught by refocusing us on what the poet is actually saying, as you said, and digging deeper into the actual words on the page and asking ourselves, why this word? Why these words in these orders? What's going on here? What do we see? And then that's the way in. And that kind of attention might not come naturally, especially to younger students. And I think the role of a teacher can be to, you know, help get the students into that space.
Well, and if I understand correctly, when you teach poetry to students, you often have them investigate, as you're saying, the actual words and the dictionary definition of those words.
Right. I mean, it's exciting because, you know, there's so many words that we take for granted that are so exciting. I mean, even a word like eclipse, I bet if we went to the Oxford English Dictionary, we can find out a lot of exciting information about the first time it was used and what else it means and what other, you know, uses of that word there were and are now. And it would be exciting and fun, and it would remind us that language is in and of itself an interesting thing.
Now you got me wondering, so I'm looking it up right now. Okay, so I'm not using the OED. I'm going to use Merriam-Webster. Eclipse, yes. We have the definitions, total or partial obscuring of one celestial body by another. First known use, 13th century.
Wow.
Wow.
And one wonders what they called it before then.
Exactly. In your book, you illustrate some of the different ways that poems work. And you ask us to look at language differently through the structure and art form of a poem in something that you call defamiliarization. So what do you mean by that?
Right. So that's a concept that a Russian literary theorist, Viktor Shklovsky was his name. He came up with this term, defamiliarization, to describe how art works in general. And he says art makes the stone stony. So it reminds us of the actuality of physical objects or of language or feelings by defamiliarizing, making things strange again so we can re-perceive them. And I found this to be a very useful idea in poetry because this is what happens. You know, poetry, I think sometimes if we don't think about it that much, we might think, oh, it's full of only fancy words, but it's actually full of simple language that's made strange and therefore new for us again.
Do you have an example? Because I think there's one by Langston Hughes that you point to in your book.
Yeah, this very short poem really struck me when I read it as a kind of perfect example of defamiliarization. It's just called Suicide's Note. The calm, cool face of the river asked me for a kiss. And what I say in the book is that the idea of a river's face, that's something that we might say that something, a building or a river or something or mountain has a face, and we don't remember that face means face. But in this case, he reminds us that the face of the river is actually literally asking to be kissed. And that, in a way, is the lure of jumping into it for the suicide.
Hmm. Who is this book for, I have to say? Because on first glance, I think, you know, is this something that would end up in a college course? Is it something for the casual reader of a poem? Who are you writing for?
I wrote it for all those people I meet who say they don't understand poetry, they don't get it, they feel like they just don't have a connection with it. And it makes me sad when I hear that because I feel like it's like saying, oh, I don't like music or I don't like food. I mean, poetry, there's so many different things that make up poetry, and I'm quite sure that for every person there are poems there. And that experience of reading poems is something that is, I wouldn't want anyone to be without if that's what they wanted. So I wrote the book for these people.
And finally, I'm just curious. I mean, the title is Why Poetry? What is your answer to that question?
There's a private answer to that and also a public one. The private answer is that it protects and enlivens a space within us of free imagination that's so precious in our current environment. And to go to a poem and read it, it's just we can reconnect with this internal landscape, our own imagination. And I think there's also a public answer to that question, too. I mean, one has to do with what we were talking about earlier about the protection of the precision of language and its accuracy. I don't need to remind our listeners that that is under threat. And poems, you know, fight back against that by being precise and interested in the actual meanings of words and their accuracy. And finally, I just say that there's a public use to poems in that they reconnect us with the imaginations of others, mm-hmm. not by telling us that other people exist, but by allowing us to actually experience another person's imagination. And that kind of empathy and that kind of connection to people distant from us is, I think that's what we need to move forward.
Yeah. So on that note, can I offer you another little excerpt of an Eclipse poem?
I would love to hear one.
This one is from a poet I've struggled with over my lifetime a little bit, but deeply admired, Siegfried Sassoon. It's kind of long, so I'm just going to read a tiny excerpt. He talks about the countermarch of clouds that troop intent, fire-crested into conflict. And then he says, at the wood's edge in bronze and olive gloom, sickness assails the sun whose blazing disk dwindles. The Eden of those auburn slopes lowers in the tarnished copper of eclipse.
Oh, my God, that's gorgeous. That's so good. I was thinking my favorite sun poem. It's not really an eclipse poem, but it's Frank O'Hara's great poem, A True Account of Talking to the Sun at Fire Island. And it's a little too long to read, but at the end of the book, I write about it. And it's just a beautiful poem where the sun wakes up Frank O'Hara, and he, and then they have a conversation where the sun reassures him of his poetic vocation. And it just ends with this, "Sun, don't go. I was awake at last. No, go I must. They're calling me. Who are they? Rising, he said, someday you'll know. They're calling to you too. Darkly he rose, and then I slept."
Fantastic. Well, Matthew Zapruder's new book is Why Poetry. It has been such a great pleasure to talk with you on this day, especially, Matthew. Thank you so much.
Me too, and thanks for sharing those great eclipse poems.
The U.S. Navy is reeling from another deadly accident involving one of its ships, and it has launched a broad investigation into the performance and readiness of the entire Pacific-based 7th Fleet. In the latest accident early today in waters off Singapore, the destroyer, the USS John McCain, collided with an oil tanker 3 times its size. The search is on for missing sailors. Just 2 months ago, 7 sailors died when the USS Fitzgerald collided with a huge container ship off the coast of Japan. Last week, the Navy announced disciplinary action against 3 of the officers on that ship. Bradley Penniston is deputy editor at Defense One. He's written extensively about the Navy. Brad, what more do we know about this most recent accident involving the USS McCain?
Well, we know that the Navy is taking it very seriously. As you mentioned, this comes rather hard on the heels of another collision. And indeed, naval warships have had at least 4 collisions in the past year and a few days. So this is something that's unusual, and the Navy's senior leadership is treating it that way. CNO John Richardson, Admiral Richardson, announced that not only would there be the standard investigation into why this happened, but in fact he's asked all fleets worldwide to stand down and to talk to their captains, their squadron commanders, their sailors about what they may be doing wrong. Yep. Why is this happening? Right. And on top of that, he's ordered a broader look into the Navy's operational tempo, trends in personnel, material, maintenance, equipment, a very broad look at why this might be happening.
Well, because what? The thinking is that perhaps there's too much stress, maybe not enough money. What's the concern?
Well, the world of the naval officer is always filled with stress. It is a difficult thing to go to sea in the most benign of conditions, and certainly sailing in Singapore, which are some of the most congested waters of the world, it's doubly so. There are all sorts of things that you can point to. You can say, yes, the surface Navy has been asked to do more with less, and that's as true now as it has been in the past decade or so. You can say that naval officers have always had to deal with this, but the question is why now? And that's what the CNO's investigation is going to try to get to the bottom of.
Well, we know in the June collision with the USS Fitzgerald, the captain was relieved of his command. Other sailors are being punished after the Navy found poor seamanship and flaws in keeping watch. Now, you mentioned how where this the McCain was in the Singapore waters, you know, it's packed. And so a lot of people wonder, how can you, you know, miss a ship? You know, how can you miss a container ship and hit it, you know, not see it and hit it? How can that happen?
Right. Well, this happened in the pre-dawn hours. This was about 21 hours ago, and it was about 6:20 local time. And anyone will tell you that dawn and dusk are the most dangerous times to be operating because, you know, things just look – things are harder to spot. Right. You can't quite tell which way everything is going. In the Fitzgerald collision – the Navy investigation blamed poor watchstander teamwork, inadequate leadership. It is just tough to do this. It is a dangerous and difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
It's amazing that the Navy does it as well as it does all around the world every day. And something went wrong this time, and they'll figure out what it was.
Well, you tweeted out this is actually the 4th accident, I think, a recent accident. Of a Navy vessel in just over a little over a year. What questions do you have?
I have the same questions the CNO has, which is what happened specifically, and is there some larger are there larger trends that are making this happen? Are the Navy's watchstander teams getting too little time at sea? Are they becoming too dependent on technology? What's going on, and how can the Navy fix it?
And by the way, this ship is named after Senator John McCain's father and his grandfather. He tweeted his thoughts and prayers today. But it had been doing something we understand in the China Seas, and it was back from that mission. What are our ships doing at sea?
So right now, there are about 50 ships in the Pacific Theater, and that runs the gamut from aircraft carriers to submarines to support ships. And in large part, they're doing what they do every day, which is some are on patrol, some are exercising with foreign navies, some are doing what we call presence missions. In particular, of interest these days, some of the ships out there are there and can be called upon for ballistic missile defense. The McCain is one of those ships. The Navy overall has about 5 dozen ships that can do ballistic missile defense. Now it's down the Fitzgerald and down the John S. McCain. This is not something the Navy wants to have happen, especially at this point in time.
Right. And when you say this point in time, isn't the U.S. about to begin drills with South Korea, and would that involve, you know, the Navy?
Yes, it's that drill is, as I understand it, more a command and control mission. It's actually a smaller drill this year than it has been, which may sound a little bit odd, but it stands to reason. The drill is focused on making sure that all the forces can respond exactly and precisely to orders, and that's more important than ever right now.
Right. Well, and most important that these lives that may be lost, these missing sailors, those some that made it to the hospital, said they were asleep. I mean, this is just where they were sleeping, below decks. Brad Penniston, deputy editor at Defense One, on another deadly accident involving one of the U.S. Navy ships, this one in Singapore. Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.